Can you tell me a story?
Sure. Once upon a time, a mom needed a new car.
Was she brave?
She was tired, mostly. But she went to Carvana.com and found a great car at a great price. No secret treasure map required.
Did she have to fight a dragon?
Nope. She bought it 100% online. From her bed, actually.
Was it scary?
Honey, it was as unscary as car buying could be.
Did the car have a sunroof?
It did, actually.
Okay, good story.
Car buying you'll want to tell stories about. Buy your car today on
Carvana.
Delivery fees may apply.
So, happy birthday, PLR. We're going to take our first dive into the 1980s right now. He went from intern to program director and everything in between. It's Eddie Saab.
Hello.
Eddie Saab and I were interns together. So this is one of those, like, when you go through the Navy SEALs program together, you become brothers for life.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. There's it's funny because as soon as I hear your name, immediately brings back memories of being 18 years old and both of us, you know, moving around the building like vultures looking for anything to grab onto.
Yeah, they used to post this schedule outside the studio, and it was Wiggy's handwritten, like he would put initials Monday through Friday. And, you know, if Lappy took a vacation or Bassman took a vacation, somebody would have to fill in. If you got the whole week, I'd be so fucking pissed.
I remember being an intern and Rockin' Mike Johnson was on the air. And at the time, Mike was a full-timer and he was on during the middle of the day and he was furious. You know, I'm a full-timer. I shouldn't be here. Now, I wasn't on the air yet.
Wait, what do you mean? He was the night show and they moved him up?
He was the night show and they made him do Thanksgiving Day.
Oh,
Day. So he was mad because it was like, oh, you're taking a tenured officer of this radio station.
Yeah.
And you're putting him on Thanksgiving Day. This is a part-timer shift. I had talked to him on the phone, and I left my parents' house with a full Thanksgiving meal, and I went straight to the radio station.
Ah, you ass kisser.
Oh, total ass kisser.
Oh, my God. This is how you worked it.
You did some of the same stuff. I mean, don't act like this is strange or foreign.
I bought the entire staff Connecticut disc jockey jackets. I gave Wiggy vintage comic books I found in this house that I bought. Yeah, we were working it.
I used to give Wiggy Monty Python stuff. I had no idea what was going on with Monty Python, but I would give him all the Monty Python stuff I could find because I figured it would get me something.
Hey, he didn't want sex from me, so I had to give him something.
Exactly. I remember bringing this Thanksgiving dinner to Rockin' Mike, and Rockin' Mike was just mother effing everybody. He was mad that he had to work the shift. And I said to him, I want you to know something, Mike. And I say this with respect. If I could kill you and hide your body and go on the air and take your shift right now and nobody would find out about it, you'd be dead already.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to be on the air that bad. I said, you know, you probably shouldn't forget that you were once me.
Yeah. It's like listening to a rich person complain. It's like, oh, my God, both your Mercedes are in the shop. Oh, do you remember your first day walking in a building?
Yes.
Who was in the building and did they match up to what you thought they'd look like?
The first person I met was Christina, who was doing middays at the time.
Smoking. Beautiful.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful blonde, the most beautiful blonde hair.
Great personality.
Yeah.
No, knew how to, like, just really could have been a model.
Yeah, 100%. And then the second person was Cappy.
Cappy.
Yeah, Caplow.
Oh, Caplow. Mark Caplow. Yeah.
Mark
Another
Caplow
suave looking man.
Yes.
Like these first two people you meet are not typical radio people. They're well dressed and they could be on television.
Well, exactly. Everybody pretty much matched up, but I was so scared. You know, I had my friends telling me, and I don't know if you had your friends telling you this. Listen, you're 18 years old. Why don't you look around that building, tell us how many radio personalities there are and how old they are. And then if you think you're going to get on the air from this internship, you're out of your mind.
Mm.
And, of course, you know, for a second you pause and you go, oh, boy, there's only really – like 11 people on the air total, including part-timers, and nobody is 18 years old. Yeah. So this may be I may have bit off more than I can chew, or this is a mountain I can't climb.
Yeah, you know what happens though? You're like, wow! Imagine if I get in the building, and then you're in the building, and you're like, wow! Imagine if they let me run the control board for one of those Sunday night programs, and then you're like,
yes.
Wow! Imagine if they let me actually open the mic and speak.
It's the equivalent of what a drug dealer does to entice someone in. They give you a little taste and you just keep wanting more and more and more. And then you basically kill yourself doing it.
You said fuck on the air.
No, I said motherfucker on
the air. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's even better.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great. I mean, at the moment when it happened, it was, I thought it was the end of my career. I thought everything
well,
was over.
If I had that tape, it would have been.
Well, you got me in two incidents. So one with the motherfucker, I did a break. The break was bad. I started swearing at myself, and I'd forgotten to shut the microphone off. So I did the break, stumbled over my words. You know.
But wait. You're glossing over the best part. So you go on the air, it's PLR, you fumble through the break, and then you turn the mic off, and you say, you motherfucker.
It was you dumb motherfucker. You dumb motherfucker, you can't even speak. And as the words were coming out of my mouth, I can hear them coming through my headphones. And immediately that was like, oh, no. Oh. Like, if I can hear me saying that, this is trouble. So I got up, went over to, because back then we would record everything, you know, on a tape deck. So I went over to the tape deck. I rewound the break, listened to it, could hear it clear as day, rewound it again, recorded over it, and then went back and just stopped the tape there. So it would just seem like that break never existed. The phones just started blowing up. You know, you just said motherfucker on the air. Do you know you just said one after another? I'm like, no, I didn't
have no idea what you're talking about.
That had to be interference. Oh no, it was definitely you. It was definitely. I'm like, no, I don't know what you're talking about.
Don't know what you're saying. So we were doing part time, and then Smith and Barber announced they're leaving for Florida. Shockwaves. Fast forward to, you know, they go through some auditions and they decide to put these two comedians who had never done radio before together, who
yeah.
really didn't even know each other, and you're the producer.
It was a disaster. It was a disaster. I learned a lot. I mean, off the air, those two guys were funny. It was Laser and Reed, funny as hell. On the air, just couldn't get him to drive down a straight road when it came to like radio comedy. I think that's what most people don't understand. Doing comedy on the radio and doing comedy on a stage, completely different.
Well, when you're on stage, you're driving. So now you have two drivers. Have you ever tried that? So usually you're going to hit a tree.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of the Laser and Reed bits?
The only one that really stands out is when we did that spoof Halloween parade going down Dixwell Avenue, and we got the traffic reporters to say avoid Dixwell Avenue and all this other stuff. We made it seem like a big news story that it was a Halloween parade.
Oh, shit,
you know,
that's pretty
really
good.
No such thing as a Halloween parade back then.
Yeah.
And it was at the same time as the Richard Kraft murder. So you remember Richard Kraft? He was the wood chipper murderer.
Yeah.
Earl Reed had a joke, which was, oh, there's Richard Kraft. He's wearing a dismembers only jacket. And that was really the highlight of what they did in the whole time I was there.
That's the only thing you can remember.
That was the only thing I can remember. I remember, you know, we would go to the phones and that would be a disaster.
So Smith and Barber come back 1994. I'm doing the night show and I leave for Texas. And then they put a couple people in that didn't work out. And then they never gave you a shot at it, the night show.
Yeah, and that was kind of like a defining moment for me, because when I was finally told that I wasn't going to get the night show, I just looked around and said, nobody that is here is ever going to leave.
Yeah.
These people are going to stay here forever. I've got to go. So I started interviewing at KC 101, which at the time was really like being, a spy. Like, you know,
you were going to the Russians.
Oh, I was betraying my country. PLR was my country.
Right. Glenn Beck was there, right? Glenn Beck went on to, the Fox television show, headline news show, has his own network now. I mean, big time.
Yeah, Glenn, I could have ridden the coattails of the $100 million man, and I chose not to. I'm not sure why to this day, but I chose not to. So I worked with Glenn, and that was interesting because there's a lot of odd characters in radio, but I worked with Glenn, which got me to work with Scott Shannon, who's a legendary New York radio guy.
It's nuts.
So I got to be friendly with him, and Scott ended up getting me a job later on. But Glenn, at one point, it was Glenn and Pat doing mornings, and they were against Smith and Barber. And Pat decided to leave and go back to Utah. So Glenn asked me to do mornings on KC 101, so I said yes.
Wow.
And did that for a little over 2 years. But programming was always where I wanted to be. I never felt like I was any good on the air. It was one of those things where I was like, I can learn stuff doing mornings that I've never learned before. And I could get the idea of what a morning guy's mind was like. And, working with Glenn, there was really no better way to learn the extremes of morning guys. Because Glenn would come in one day and be laughing and happy and everything was great. And then the next day he would come in and he would want to be on his soapbox and just pontificate for 4 hours. So you never knew what you were going to get. You were going to be funny one day. Then the next day you were talking about the children. What about the children? They're not being fed properly. Let's take care of the children. And that would be a whole show. And then the next day we'd be doing dick jokes.
I think that you saw him in the infancy stage where it's like going to the bar and watching Eddie Van Halen play Black Sabbath. And then he's playing something from Motown. You know, he's not really sure exactly what he wants to do. You know, and then you finally find that sound, and he found this sound.
I think maybe it takes all of us a long time in this business to find like our voice and what our real connection is with the audience.
If you go to KC 101, you do a lot for your career there, and then you leave KC 101 and you go to work for the Fox. As program director.
Wiggy got me that job. I let them know right away when I got that job that the day, Wiggy retired, because I expected, Wiggy would probably work until 65 and then just retire.
You wanted to be in the on-deck circle.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I wanted. And then I was in a pool at beaches in Jamaica, got a phone call from the COO of the company then. He let me know that, Wiggy was no longer the program director, and was I interested?
Fuck yeah. Yeah.
It was, yes. What do you want me to send right now? Do you want me to fly home right now? And he's like, no, you can wait till you get back. That's when my return to PLR happened. That was 2002.
What was that like walking into the building? Most of these legendary air personalities remember you as an intern. And then now you're the boss. How weird was that? Was it tough?
It was tough. I was scared to death. I was really, really scared to death.
How long into your run as program director did you feel like you were going to have to, or that you should replace the morning show, or that you wanted to?
It was September of 2002 that Bruce had come to me and said there were some issues. So I started kind of drilling down on the different issues, started working with both of them to try to straighten them out and get everything going in the right direction. But it just, it wasn't happening. We were actually regressing. It was time. So when the contract was up, we ended it.
Was their contract up?
The contract was up. Yeah. Oh, we told them we wouldn't be renewing their contract. It was, maybe a month or so before the contract ended.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. And so, but this is your first big program director gig. And the first, Well, the biggest thing you do in your first year is replace a legendary Heritage morning show. It's a lot. You know, it's a big risk.
Yeah, and I could tell you, everyone reminded me often of what a risk it was. That you could just you may have just thrown your gig away by doing this. And you know, the way the company worked, it was, hey, we all sit in a room, we all make this decision, we make it as a group, and then you know, we go forward and we do it. Well, this decision was so big, we sat down, we made the decision as a group, and then when it was over, it was, Ed, are you sure you want to do this?
You want to do this?
Like, oh, hang on. I thought this was a decision we were making as a group. There's six of us sitting in this room.
Wait.
Like, yeah, no, in the end, this comes down on you. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I, you know, from what we originally talked about, I didn't think that's the way this was going to work. But, and I also knew that the window was closing for me to get it done. Because you have that when you're a new program director somewhere, you have that honeymoon period where they think everything you say is good.
Well, it's the first 2 years of a presidency. If you have the House and the Senate, you can get things through. But also, they were going to, you know, if they were at the end of their deal, they were going to resign. So you'd be, you know, whatever their deal was, 2 or 3 years, you know.
So it was important to get it done then and get it done fast. And I could still see the folder that was called Project X, and that was where everything Chaz and AJ went into. So I was monitoring you guys because you were on the island at the time, so I was able to pick up Riverhead at the radio station. So I was monitoring you guys, keeping notes, and you know, kind of following along with you know everything you were doing and you had going on. So Project X was in the folder, and that's what I was you know, feeding to all the upper management.
Oh, that should be like the pseudonym of the morning show, Project X. So the morning show gets in, gets established pretty quick, and then you have to, due to a corporate decision, take Jimmy Koplik off the air. He was co-hosting the Mike and Jimmy concert show once a week on PLR. Jimmy, in a podcast, said it was very unprofessional how it was done.
I agree. Jimmy's right. There are certain things that stick with you your entire life. That meeting with Jimmy, I could close my eyes and see it right now. And it hurts now as much as it hurt then, because I knew then I was doing the wrong thing and I had no choice. It was a corporate decision. But I geared myself up so much because I used to answer the phones for Jimmy. Because back then, Jimmy did the concert show with Bassman.
Yeah, it's Jimmy fucking Koplik. And now you have to sit down with Jimmy. It's like you're sitting across from George Washington saying, maybe we could have other presidents, you know?
Yeah. So they, you know, they let me know that I've got to do this. I sit down with him, and of course, my head is spinning at 3,000 miles per hour. And all I kept saying to myself was, Jimmy's a professional. He's going to want me just to say it and just get it to him. Right. Here's the information. The show is done. This is the research we got back on it. And that's it. And, you know, you can let Anita in accounting go that way, but you don't tell a fucking concert god.
Yeah. No, you're
that.
Right.
You're ending the show that way. Because Jimmy's first thing was like, wait a minute, so you're saying you're ending it all together? Like, we're not going to just do it once a month or, you know, a few times a year. You're ending it completely. I was like, yeah, no, the show's done. It's over. And Jimmy just laid into me, deservedly so. He laid into me, got up, walked out. He said, you'll never see me again. You'll never get any of my business. And I'll never be back on the station. And you just lost, you know, our relationship more than anything.
Wow.
And I tried hard to get that relationship back, just as a friend to friend, non business related, because you know, not too far after I realized that it was something that came down from corporate. It wasn't driven by me. And it had told me a number of times that, you know, he didn't blame me.
Yeah, luckily Jimmy's back on the radio station now. And
And it does, it bring, I will say, when I hear, you know, when I'm listening to you and I hear you say, you know, coming up in 15 minutes, you know, concert god, Jimmy Complex, I mean, it makes me feel good every single time I hear it, because I, just knowing that everything got back on track, you know, that was, a, it was, a, that period was horrible, but, you know, to see everything back on track and working the way it is now, it makes my heart feel good.
And then you got fired.
And then I got fired.
And yeah. not because of Jimmy, because...
No, it was this asshole morning show that I brought in, decided they wanted to play less music. I'm just kidding.
No, okay, you just went through your rub that is still sore.
Uh-huh.
This is a sore spot with me. And it hurts me that you lost your dream job because we thought we would do a better morning show by playing less music. We just thought the upper echelon, the powers, were like, okay, just keep bringing me those numbers.
Well, and that's what it was. The less music you played, the higher the ratings went. And the other thing was that one of the managers did know what was going on and said, if corporate ever gets mad about the fact that they're dropping songs, don't worry about it. I'll jump in front of the bullet for you. And
how did that work out?
Well, see, that's what bothers me there, is that I'm a guy that for my staff, I always jumped in front of bullets, no matter what. That was important to me, that you guys felt protected from upper management. Me being in the middle would save you. And him telling me that he was going to jump in front of the bullet for me if something happened, I felt comfortable. And of course, the numbers kept going up and up and up to the point where we were the number one rock station in the nation. And then, well, they found out about, you know, they realized what was going on with the music. I don't know how they suddenly just realized it, but they suddenly realized it. And I got let go. I got brought in. It started with an email. What's going on with the music on the radio station? Then it was a phone call. I could tell by the call that I was about to get fired.
Yeah.
So as I was driving to the station, I was taking out my key card and my regular keys. I knew I was walking in to hand everything over. And that's exactly what happened. I was walked in and let go.
Yeah, that's a tough one, because it's, you know, when you grow up listening to PLR and then you work your way through as an intern, you work your way up to program director, and it's a tough one. It's like a divorce, you know?
It's almost worse. Yeah. It's like a death.
Yeah. It's a better way to put it.
It is. And, you know, there were a whole bunch of years that, you know, I didn't do anything revolving, you know, around the radio station at all. And then, you know, I ran into Kristen, and Kristen said, hey, you know, you should come up sometime. And I was like, no,
she's our market vice president now.
Yeah. And I was like, nah, I'm good. I love everybody there. I'm still friends with everybody. It's all good. But, you know, I don't need to come by. And I had gotten out of radio at that point. And she said, come up, you'll see. I think you'll like what you see. So the more I thought about that, and, you know, I started kind of setting goals for myself for things I wanted to do in my life. And one of them was get back on the air. So I went up and walked around the building, said hi to everybody. It was really nice. The atmosphere felt great. And when I was done, Keith, you know, said, hey, if you're interested in doing some part-time stuff, well, let's do it. And so I ended up getting back into radio because of PLR.
Well, when they fired you, they brought me and AJ in, and we sit down, and there's the general manager, and then the big market. I mean, she didn't just run the market; she ran like a quadrant, section of the country of radio stations, and she happened to be based out of our building. So I walk into her office, we all sit down. She said, "I just fired Eddie Saab." Okay, I said, you know, you should actually, if you're going to fire anyone, fire me, because it was my decision to not play the songs. And as the words are coming out of my mouth, I'm like, what the fuck am I saying? I'm like, why? What? Mortgage? Money? College?
I got a phone call after you had that meeting, from someone who was in that meeting to let me know that you stood up and said, well, you should be letting us go, too. And I was like, well, that would have been a horrible idea.
No, I didn't say too. I said instead of, because I thought that if I sacrificed myself, you would have a job.
Yeah, and no, that would have been a bad move.
For me?
For you, for the radio station, all the way around.
Do you have a Sam T story?
Every Christmas, ZZ Top would send me a pecan pie. And, you know, would see, later in life, Sam had lost a lot of weight. But, you know, he was big. And
he loved so food. Loved,
Sam loved food.
We've bonded over that many times.
Oh, yeah. The pecan pie would show up just before Christmas every single year before Sam would take his 2 weeks away. So I didn't eat pecan pie, but this box that the pecan pie came in was signed by all the members of ZZ Top, and it would usually say thanks to me or thanks to the radio station. So I wanted this wood box that it came in. So I kept the box. Sam took the pie. So the first year Sam takes the pie, he's like, man, that pie was excellent. You have no idea how, you don't know what you're missing. Pecan pie is fantastic. And I was like, yeah, I'm not interested. The next year, the pecan pie shows up. And by this point, Sam and I are so close. Really, it's like a father and son relationship. We were as tight as can be. So Sam said, yeah, man, it was my vacation. I was sitting home watching the Dolphins game. And I had a slice of that ZZ Top pecan pie. And I was like, good, huh? He goes, yeah, but then I got up and I had another slice. And then I got up and, you know, I just grabbed the whole tin. And I sat down and I ate the whole pie during the Dolphins game. I was like, you ate a whole pecan pie? Are you serious? He's like, yeah, man. He goes, you know, I started feeling funny. So I walked to the bedroom, but by the time I got about halfway there, I couldn't see anymore. I was like, what are you talking about? You know, I didn't understand because I had no idea what happened if you were diabetic and you ate a lot of sugar.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
So I was like, what's going on? He goes, yeah. He goes, I ended up crawling the rest of the way to the bedroom. I climbed up to my bed, and I laid down, and I figured if I just went to sleep and I woke up in the morning, my sugar would level out, and I would be fine. And that's exactly what happened. And I was like, Sam, you could have died. Do you realize that could have killed you? And he was like, yeah, no, I was fine. So then the next year, here it is Christmas. Here comes the pecan pie from ZZ Top. Sam comes in. I see you got the pecan pie. So I'm throwing it out. I said, you're not getting it. So I never gave Sam another pecan pie because I was afraid of what he was going to do with it. But listen, I have a thousand Sam T stories.
A great, beautiful Sam, man.
Just an absolutely beautiful man who raised two amazing kids. I mean, just the greatest guy and taught me so much about radio and so much about life as well.
He was the marketing director, and in PLR's 50 years, we've only had three marketing directors, Rose, Sam, and Drew. And Drew came up under Sam like a son. But Sam brought us both in as interns. He was the guy who said, you're allowed to be in this building. Now here, lick these envelopes. Just you were in the studio with this guy a lot, and I know most people listening know and remember Rockin' Mike, but he did the night show in the late 80s.
It was the craziest time to be in rock radio. You know, Rockin' Mike, to his credit, with Guns N' Roses, Rockin' Mike saw Guns N' Roses being massive before anyone else did. Because at that time, PLR wasn't playing Guns N' Roses. And the Guns N' Roses album was locked in the music director's office. So Mike used to have me go and pick the lock for the music director's office and pull out the album and play it on the air. And Mike got in trouble for doing that multiple times, but it didn't matter. He just kept saying, the listeners deserve Guns N' Roses. The listeners deserve Guns N' Roses. So there's no way I'm going to stop playing this record. And you know what? We didn't. We kept playing it, and then it ended up making the playlist, and the rest is history.
Yeah, we didn't play it because there's artwork on there that depicts, it's a cartoon image, but it depicts a woman who was just raped by a robot. So we were protesting that.
Yeah, and the other thing with that album is it wasn't as much Welcome to the Jungle or Sweet Child of Mine that we were playing at night. It was more Night Train and Mr. Brownstone and stuff like that. That's just a really hard, grinding Guns N' Roses stuff.
I remember the very first time I heard Welcome to the Jungle, I was in the PLR production room looking through the glass at Rockin' Mike Johnson. He's got it cranked to 15, and he's got a pen, and he's hitting the overhead light. He was using it as a cowbell.
Wow, you just brought back a visual for me that I had forgotten about. And yeah. He did it all the time.
Yeah, he was something special.
He was the first person I had ever met that could walk into a room and change the complexion of the room immediately without saying a word. He had this glow. He had this energy that no one else had. I think it was partially because he partied so hard and he was so kind of footloose and fancy free, you know, and that's my relationship with Rockin' Mike always stayed great. Until like I started getting on the air more often, getting like better airships, and then it started to kind of die off. And then Mike, you know, resigned from the radio station, and he resigned because he wanted to. We were doing album specials at night, and he felt like there should be spaces between the songs, just like on the album. And Wiggy felt like we should be playing two albums, playing one song into the next, so they segued nicely, and it was a smooth transition if someone was recording it. And Mike disagreed. They got into an argument, and Mike said, "I'm resigning." And he went over to the IBM Selectric typewriter to resign, and I'm like, "Mike, don't do this. You're making the biggest mistake of your life. But in the back of my head, I'm thinking, well, if he goes, some positions are going to open up.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, I'm telling him not to do it. And I remember Lappy calling me and saying, "Hey, let's get together and talk." And this was before Mike was gone. It was before Wiggy had accepted his resignation. And Mike and I, we get in his little Volkswagen. We start driving around, and he's like, "Hey, you got any weed on you? Yeah. You got papers? Yeah. Well, give them to me." So here's Mike driving a standard shift car. I hand him a bag of weed and rolling papers. He starts driving with his knee, rolling a joint. And as he's rolling the joint, he looks at me and he goes, "You know, you're hanging out with the wrong people. You're going to get yourself in trouble. There, you know, things are going on at night that you shouldn't be involved with."
As he's rolling a joint and shifting.
As he's rolling a joint and shifting, he goes, "From now on, you hang out with Wiggy and I." And, you know, that was the ultimate compliment at the time, to say, "I can hang out with you and Wiggy."
Yeah.
And he was like, "Yep." He goes, "During the wig outs on Friday afternoon, start coming up." And what I realized was I was just a glorified errand boy. I would go to the package store, and as soon as I'd walk in with my PLR jacket, the big thing of Captain Morgan would come up from behind, you know, the register with a case of Grolsch beer, which is what Lappy drank at the time.
Yeah, but that was how Henry Hill started.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Selling cigarettes.
Right. Well, it was,
so, yeah, that was the beginning.
It was, you know, PLR is just such a special place for so many different people. And it's weird to have this honor to be a part of it, to actually talk about it from this perspective.
It's hard to put into words what it feels like being a member of the fraternity that is PLR. It's hard to describe.
What is neat about it is that the folks who listen feel just as much a part of the station as we do, you know? And I think that that's the difference between other radio stations. You listen to other radio stations, but this station, you're a part of it, you know? Does that make sense?
I learned that the first White House concert that I was involved with, I think there were 15,000 people there, and every person who came up to me talked to me like they've known me forever, and I went, "Oh, this is family."
Yeah.
These listeners, they're family. These aren't people that just casually pay attention to the music that's on the radio. They're involved in everything we do.
Yeah. I always consider myself a listener who got a show, you know? So
that's probably the best way to look at it.
Yeah. Well, Ed, thanks for the memories here. Thanks for, you know, changing my life by bringing me in as morning show host. It's just great to be able to call you a very, very close personal friend.
I feel exactly the same way.
And especially to have shared the same time, the same run at the station together.
Well, and the fact that we were so competitive against each other, but we didn't dislike each other. We loved each other, but yet still had that competitive fire burning. That's what I always enjoyed the most about our relationship in the early days.
Yeah, I fucking hated it. I think you bent my car antenna.
I'm not going to say I didn't.
All right, man. Love you, brother.
All right, brother. I love you. I'll talk to you.
Okay, bye.